Good evening and welcome, dear friends. Each of you, as I see you, all of us are blessings for one another as we come together in our shared intention for the fullness of human possibility in and of and as Christ. So we join in holy remembering this evening, knowing that there is light. There is the matter of time. There are laws of the universes, and there are possibilities for each one of us. In a fully embodied life of spaciousness and abundance. So the Christ candle is lit as a symbol of this light, and in so lighting it, we affirm that the conscious circle of humanity is gathered with us and can inform us. So we begin in the name of God transcendent, God omnipresent, and God immanent, the Holy Living Trinity. Amen. So we begin in memory and celebration of one of the foundational teachers of the Fourth Way, and that is P.D. Ouspensky, born March 5th, 1878 in Russia, in that part now known as Ukraine. He met Mr. Gurdjieff when he was 37 in Russia and studied with him for 10 years. Thereafter, he had his own groups in England and in the United States. He was the one who introduced Maurice Nickel and his family to Mr. Gurdjieff. And like Gurdjieff himself, he traveled extensively, principally in the Mideast, in search of knowledge. He was specifically interested in the search of the knowledge of science and philosophy in order to understand the purpose of a human life. And his papers are archived today at Yale University. This is what Rodney Collin had to say about him. I first met Ouspensky in London, where he was giving private lectures in September 1936. These lectures referred to an extraordinary system of knowledge, quite incomparable with anything I had ever encountered, which he had received from a man he simply called G. The system, however, was not new. On the contrary, it was said to be a very ancient one, which had always existed in some hidden form, and traces of which could from time to time be seen coming to the surface of history in one guise or another. Although it explained in an extraordinary way countless things about man and the universe, which had seemed hitherto quite inexplicable, its sole purpose, as O constantly stressed, was to help individual men to awaken to a different level of consciousness. O never worked for the moment. It might even be said that he did not work for time. He worked only for recurrence. But this needs much explanation. In any case, he quite evidently worked and planned with a completely different sense of time from the rest of us. Though to those who impatiently urged him to help them achieve quick results, he would say, "No, time is a factor. You can't leave it out." So as we move into part two of our curriculum on living time, we will find that Mr. Ouspensky is quoted often. Sometimes the writing may be obtuse to us, yet it is possible to find living truth in this living time and this timeless work. So may it be so for us, for each one of us, that something comes to meet us. And speaking of time, we have now stepped over the threshold into the great cycle of Lent. How does it come to meet us? What is being called forth in terms of where to place our attention, how to use our time? Well, that is the subject of tonight's lesson. So we will pause now and prepare ourselves in this time and place, in each of our atmospheres, so to speak, and come to the present moment. And what we bring now matters. How we come now matters. How we participate matters. For that is what we are emanating into this group. And collectively, we are emanating out into the world. So let us come with intention and immanent trust and receptivity to the influences coming from the circle of conscious humanity. And we prepare to receive them with all the consciousness that we can muster. With back upright, heart open, the mind quiet, in directed attention, body relaxed, noticing perhaps and then releasing all tension, all constriction, all resistance. We breathe in deeply, all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything, everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy, all affirming, all denying. And we hold it as offering, reconciled, as food for being. We lift it and ask that it all be transubstantiated in our being, as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. As we ourselves are the beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I open to the divine human life that is mine. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. And we now enter into Lectio Divina. And our passage this evening will be read 3 times. That you, rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the holy ones what is the breadth and length and height and depth, to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, so that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Why must love give comprehension? Love is the highest of all emotions, the synthesis, the blending of all highest emotions. This leads to sanctity. Sanctity is the state of the spirit liberated from the duality of man, the disharmony of soul and body. Sanctity united to knowledge may comprehend into a new phase of consciousness that is impossible without the expansion of the space, time, sense, filled with all the fullness of God. Thus, it is a matter of some importance where we place our attention in order to co-create our relation to life and all its events. That you, rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the holy ones what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, so that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Why must love give comprehension? Love is the highest of all emotions, the synthesis, the blending of all highest emotions. This leads to sanctity. Sanctity is the state of the spirit liberated from the duality of man, the disharmony of soul and body. Sanctity united to knowledge may comprehend into a new phase of consciousness that is impossible without the expansion of the space, time, sense, filled with all the fullness of God. Thus, it is a matter of some importance where we place our attention in order to co-create our relation to life and all its events. that you, rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the holy ones what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, so that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Why must love give comprehension? Love is the highest of all emotions, the synthesis, the blending of all highest emotions. This leads to sanctity. Sanctity is the state of the spirit liberated from the duality of man, the disharmony of soul and body. Sanctity, united to knowledge, may comprehend into a new phase of consciousness that is impossible without the expansion of the space-time sense, filled with all the fullness of God. Thus, it is a matter of some importance where we place our attention in order to co-create our relation to life and all its events. And so it is. So we will stop sharing now the screen and invite whomever is moved to do so to share what you received from this passage, from this wondrous image, or what came to meet you. Perhaps someone who hasn't shared for a while too. Even though Jim and Steve, I would like you both to share. But let's start with Jim.
Yeah, this morning when I first received the email, which I think consistently comes in at about 5 o'clock in the morning,
yes,
I was drawn to reread it. And that part about attention drew my attention, and it had me start to think about attention and about the attention that I have, and that was just kind of lingering in me, and then I went into my morning sit, and as I was moving deeper and deeper into my morning sit, I observed in myself that it was trying to control my attention, and there was a lot of frustration there. And I immediately had a sense that I could just let go of trying, and that doing that was just a movement of grace, and as I relaxed more, the attention was collected in a real soft way, and it was just it was heaven reaching me and just reminding me that I don't have to work so hard.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Howard.
So the second paragraph, and I'm trying to remember it now, but the last part of it where it talked about really feeling into kind of what I got from it was in this time of Lent and to a certain extent stepping outside of some of the comfort zones and doing things in a little bit of a different way, that that left a time space, a larger space to be filled with God. And that more fullness, I guess, of God is kind of really what I've just took away from it, that feeling of that feeling of that, I guess, fullness, and not having it taken away by all the external worldly things. So I really could resonate with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. Martin, please. Good evening.
Good evening. The image, I look at the world sitting there and I just, you know, the first thing I wonder why it doesn't just fall down. And it's going around the sun's going around something else, the galaxy's going around something else, and all of it. And this, you know, you can add up all those velocities and get into the whole science of what's really happening there. And I don't know, that's just kind of where my mind is going, but I was thinking, and I can't really apply a prayer to that. You know, I pray that this stays for another billion years. I don't know what it is, but the statement that, you know, love surpasses all understanding. Christ's love surpasses all understanding. Whew, I can pray to live into that. And that seems a little better use of my time, perhaps.
It does. Yes. Thank you. Amen, Martin. So, how wonderful. We'll do Kay and Catherine and perhaps Jackie and Karen, and then we'll close this section. But we'll have to be brief. Thank you. Thank you, Kay.
Hi, everybody. The first thing I noticed was in the image, there's crosses all yeah. over the place. Yeah. I didn't notice that in the printed image. And then I was like, why are those crosses there? And so I listened more carefully to the words, and the words that hit me were filled with all the fullness of God. And then also there was a lot of love is the highest emotion. And I thought, well, of course, God's highest way he showed us that he loved us was the cross. Mm-hmm. And that's all over the universe. And I don't know, just this is a good way to start Lent.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Beautiful. Thank you, Kay. Thank you. Catherine. Welcome.
Hi there, everybody. So I struggled through this email this morning, and I got to the line that was in the Lectio, thus it is a matter of some importance where we place our attention in order to co-create our relation to life and all its events. And it stopped me in my tracks, and I went, that's what this is all about. Not just this email, but like, doing the work and applying things to ourselves and co-creating with God, which is always my favorite way to think about God's relationship with us as we go about our events and make effort to transform them, and that it does matter. You know, it does matter, and it's of great importance. So I was just glad to be reminded of all of that in such a succinct way.
Mm. Thank you, Catherine. Yes, indeed. Jackie, please.
Hi, good evening. When I opened up the email, I've really enjoyed each email this series because I've had some anticipation of where we were heading, and I really didn't anticipate time which is one of my very favorite work topics. And Living Time, Dr. Nichols' book is my absolute favorite of the non-commentary Nichol books. Every time there's been a class on that book, I've taken it. And payment, I've received gifts and gifts from payment. And the payment is, it takes a great deal of attention and a lot of directed attention initially, because these are huge ideas. These are completely mind-altering ideas that are being offered to understand time, which is a construct by humans. So that we would end this lesson with attention makes perfect sense to me, that if our understanding of understanding is the conjunction of knowledge and being, that for me anyway, I have to start with directed attention to really pay as much as I can to a study that may be beyond my reach at the time. And to struggle against those eyes that are going, oh, you can't understand this, or this is too much, or I've had enough of it, till I get to the point of attracted attention. Mm-hmm. And when I get to attracted attention, it's all mine. And that's where I am with the ideas, amazing ideas of Living Time. So thank you for this next section. This is going to be awesome.
Thank you, Jackie, for that small commercial there you have as an enticement for all of us to continue to persevere, as Thomas Keating always invited us to do. So we'll conclude our sharings with you, Karen. Good evening.
Good evening, Marianne and everyone. Oh, wow. Well, the things that struck me the most, or what was going on in my head, were the attention, because I've used attention and directed attention, as Jackie was saying, a lot in terms of, you know, where is my attention? Where am I? What's going on in my head? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? And those are the things that I've learned here at CCH, and that inform me of what's available to me from God, from love. And these, you know, saying those words for me is very foreign, I'll tell you the truth. But they don't feel foreign anymore. And what I've noticed is, if I'm paying attention, God's word comes to me every day, some way, somehow, all the time.
In my little bit of pink tonight, I can hear it.
And so, you know, that gives me hope. It gives me, support. I know that that's there. And I love the idea of thinking that, I don't have to live with my old rules. I don't have to live with being angry. I don't have to live with being negative. And what freedom I have felt from paying attention. Yes. I think I'll just end there.
Yes. Thank you, Karen. That was a perfect way to transition actually into the next part of our time. And I am delighted to introduce Ken Ely, who will accompany us in the sharings of the closing of part one of our curriculum for this year, and will introduce us to part two, Living Time. So good evening and welcome, Ken.
Well, thank you, Marianne. Good evening, everyone, and good to see everybody. First off, I was just scrolling through the screen and I see many of my guides teachers, fellow work students, some long time, some very new. It's humbling to be here, and I'm grateful to be here with each of you. Just as a backdrop before we get into the homework, one of the things that I've heard a lot kind of in the community, and it's more than a few times, is that these ideas are really complex and that they're coming at us really fast. And that is true. They are. In my experience, the work can be complex, and it does take time. It takes a long time. It's like a 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzle with no edges. All the pieces are gray and there's no picture on the box. So where do you begin? Well, we begin by studying the pieces, by doing the work. The puzzle is not just the work. The puzzle is us. We are this 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzle, and it's worth each of our time. J.G. Bennett said that Gurdjieff gave us the fundamental structures of the work. He kind of gave us the core teachings, but he left it to his students to work out the rest. And that's been my experience. There's a tremendous amount of knowledge that's been worked out by his students and by their students, you know, the students' students. And what I see happening here in the Journey School is that we're each making contributions to the evolution of the work, and each of us have a role to play in bringing this work to life. And our contributions matter because they serve everyone on the journey. So, you know, what I'm observing is there's a lot of people here. There's a lot of wisdom that can be shared. And ideally, we would hear more points of view week to week to illuminate our journey. And, you know, there's probably some here that are new and they're not sure how to do this. So as a practical tool, I'm going to offer an experience of my own sharing over the years of perhaps what to avoid. And maybe as a, you know, to highlight what is of service to others in sharing. The experience is this, that many times over the years, when I would get up to share, Tim Cook, our founder, would say, "Now let's keep it brief, Ken." And if I didn't trust him in the role that he was playing, I would probably have taken it personally. And I would probably have stopped sharing. But I wondered why he was saying that. Why was he saying that to me? I thought he was only saying it to me, but I realized later he was saying that to others. But what I learned is that my sharings were a jumbled mess. Like my thoughts, kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. My thoughts were not clear. I was talking too long, maybe like you think I'm doing right now. I was not externally considering others. And the result was that I was taking time from others and not clearly conveying something that could be useful. So tonight, we're going to have a bit of a briefer period of sharing. We may have time toward the end, you know, but it'll be a brief period of sharing. And I'd like to invite longtime work students to come forward and demonstrate how to effectively share in service to others so that we can all learn from your example. Some of the sharings earlier were very good examples. Just be conscious of the time. Keep the sharings brief. Structure your sharings so that they benefit others by using the work language, and stay within the topic. And our topic, I can put it up real quick. Our topic was shocks. And just as a reminder, put these up here, and I'll put it into the presentation mode. And I guess I gotta flip that. Are we on the right? I think we're on the right screen. So the homework was on shocks. I think we had a very good overview of that last week from Peter. So just take a minute to remember. And who has something to offer? Gay, please.
Thank you, Ken. I would like to share a shock that I received this week. Quite often, I find that the work itself comes to meet me when I need it. And that's what happened this week. The event that triggered this went something like this. Two of my beloved family members, it came to my attention, were having a big, not just a disagreement, but an unloving series of things that were happening in their life. And for some reason, this disturbed me quite deeply, and I pretty much lost myself. And an eye that is quite familiar in my life came up in response to this inharmonious relationship between my two beloveds. And I began to think that I could somehow turn this around or fix this relationship. I even, in my own mind, I concocted exactly what I was going to say to bring this about, that I was going to completely change the situation between these two people. And I had, it was quite a detailed, detailed monologue in my head. And fortunately, before I could actually enact this between the two people who were supposed to come to my house in a couple of days after this, I actually reread, probably for the third time, the email about shocks. And there's a paragraph in that email that specifically says, you cannot, you must not, you should not try to create a shock for another person. Because a shock is in essence, it is grace. It is for me alone, for my own shocks. So this reading this became a shock. It became the shock in the event that I got to see a recurring I, first of all. I got to see that their relationship is something that they will work out ultimately without my help. So I was so grateful to have read that before I actually took action as I had planned to. Thank you.
Thank you, Gay. Appreciate that. It's very, very good. Thank you. I appreciate your work. Lisa, please.
Good evening, Ken. Thanks for facilitating tonight. So I received a shock 10 years ago from my brother-in-law, and anxiety and depression has run in my mother's side of my family. And 10 years ago, my brother-in-law told me on the phone, don't come visit us in Ohio until you get some help. And this one was in denial. And in the 20 years that I had known my brother-in-law, he had never spoken to me that way. So the body first felt it, and it felt like a sucker punch. And then the emotion was feeling very hurt, feeling shamed. And then the intellectual center kicked in. And it was interesting because the intellectual center didn't want to fight back. The intellectual center took it in as, this is something that Lisa needs to really think about. And so he really changed my life. I had the courage to go get help, go get some medication to help with the anxiety. I had been in the work for about 10 years. I'd been doing yoga for 10 years and eating healthy. And I came to the point in my life where I realized other help was needed. And it saved my life. And fast forward, I'm now living into the shock of my mother's demise, mental demise. And I'm working against very fearful eyes that are telling me that's your future. And I don't want to hear or believe or give voice to those eyes. So that's my work now, in a shock that seems to be reverberating for days, because I'm in the environment right now. So
what you shared with us was a conscious memory that will help you through that. Three-centered observation, conscious memory. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
I am so grateful for this long line. I'm going to be able to take two more. So we'll take Tamara and then Mimi, please. And then we'll hopefully have time toward the end.
So hi, Ken, and hello, everybody. I learned a lot from this email because it kind of reminded me of all the work tools that I have to do first conscious shock. And, you know, I love the idea that when I'm in a situation, and, you know, I could go on and on about different situations I've been in where I used one of the work tools, whether is, you know, you owe me nothing, I owe you everything, or, anyways, you know, all the tools going to the, you know, volume six. But the one thing that has stood out to me over the years is self-remembering. And I thought to myself, out of all the tools that I use, self-remembering gives me the most conscious shock. Because if I do self-remembering and centering prayer, the two of those combined, which I think it's a beautiful thing that we have those two pillars in the church. We have Thomas Keating teaching us about centering prayer. And then we have the work. And for me, one of the biggest tools I have is self-remembering. And I feel like it runs across every single tool we have. And how do I do that? I do that by doing my sit twice a day. And I give myself a conscious shock every day by doing my sits, doing my centering prayer. And, you know, I've been reading a book called Golden recently. It was recommended by Peter, and it talks about how being in the silence kind of topples your ego, you know, knocks the ego off of its podium. And for me, that's what I need every single day for a conscious shock. I also like to think of the crucifix, and you've got the vertical and you've got the horizontal. And that, to me, when I'm doing my sit and doing my self-remembering, I'm taken off of the horizontal and I'm being brought back to the vertical. So I love the idea of sending prayer as a conscious shock. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And we're going to be talking about self-remembering tonight too. Thanks for bringing that in. Mimi, please.
I had a really good shock last week. I got all ready for a couple weeks, got dressed, which, you know, put on some fancy clothes, put on my makeup, and I showed up to facilitate last week's class. And I'm in the chat room, in the Zoom room, and I'm thinking, wonder why Peter's here. And so I waited for everybody to go through the wonderful things they go through to make sure things go smooth. And I said, excuse me, am I supposed to be here? And Marianne very nicely said, no. And the shock of that, being on the night of shock, was so good. What happened for me was I was in a place of self-remembering because of the shock. It just kind of knocks you off your feet. You know, I'm so cool. I'm all ready. I did my hair and makeup. Let's go. And then bam. Nothing, you know, get back in the queue, find out what night you're really supposed to be here. And the humor of it, that's why I had to share with y'all. It's just the humor. And so probably not a real concise work report, but I'm all in for shocks at any time. And have proved to most of you, and will prove to the new people, that I'll be a fool for the work any day. So thank you guys, and let's have fun.
That was perfect, and I'm right there with you. We'll see how much of a fool for the work I am this evening. Thank you. Well, thank you for sharing. And I apologize that it looks like I'm looking off into the distance. I just have two screens here, so bear with me. Looks like we need to change that. Are we on the correct? Somebody give me a thumbs up. Thank you. Thank you each for sharing and modeling for us. I too am a student. And so I would also like to share my experience of a shock that I received on a Thursday class many years ago. After I had shared my experience of the homework, the leader of the class said this: "You know, Ken, you've been coming here a while, and I've heard you share a number of times, and they've all been about your little W work. I've not heard you share about your experience with your family or others outside your work. Are you aware of that?" Now, the shock was not my lack of awareness. The shock was that it was out in the open. And someone raised this earlier, that shocks are not supposed to be coming from other folks. But I would say that there was a difference in this case. I received many shocks from the leader sitting in the chair, that I felt that was coming through grace. Did not feel that it was personal at all. But back to this shock, my personality preferred to keep all of its worlds separate. No way did it want to get personal. My experience of that shock was this: there was a cacophony of no's from the legion inside. No. none of them wanted the light on them. I felt emotions of fear and panic with a little twinge of relief that this had been called out in the open. Heart was racing and the mouth went dry. And I'm not sure whether or not I actually answered the question, but there was really nothing to say. Right is right. What that shock gave me was a conscious memory. I didn't necessarily change what I chose to share, at least not right away, but I can tell you that from that moment on, I have never forgotten it. Not once when I picked up the mic to share. It has always been with me, and it drove me to expand my work to my family, to all that I encountered, and to drop the walls that were built inside to supposedly protect me. So it's in that spirit that I'm going to guide the rest of our time this evening to illuminate some of these work ideas through my personal experience of the work. So as Marianne introduced, our topic for the evening is causality and time, which is essentially how and why events happen in our lives. What does this mean in work terms, and how can we apply it to ourselves? So before we go too deep, it's fitting to ask, how did you come here to be here tonight? And now that you're here, why? What's your aim? This is really our exploration. For many years, I heard those questions in some form asked from the person leading the class. And, you know, if you're listening, Peter asks those questions every Sunday. So the questions must be important to our work. And I will say that for a very long time, longer than I'd probably want to admit, maybe even still presently it happens, my response to those questions was fear that I'd be called on to answer the question, that I'd be found out, that I didn't really know what my aim was or how I got here. But what I did know is that I was hungry for something, so I kept showing up. So if you don't know how you got here or why you're here, no worries. I'm not going to call on you to answer tonight. However, I do invite you to take this as a wake-up call. Or in the spirit of last week's class, as a shock to ask yourself this question before you come next time. So how I got here, I do know that. I do know how I got here. I came to be here tonight. And now that I'm here, I do know my aim. What brought me here is what I'd best call a compulsion to share an experience that I've had that only a group like this would understand and benefit from. It's not a desire, didn't ask for it. It felt more like a choice that was made for me long before I became aware of it. And when the opportunity arose, I said yes. And it was only after saying yes that I discovered what I'm really in for. And I could say that pretty much sums up my journey. Now that I'm here, my aim is to inspire a desire to know and understand these ideas, to provide a framework to answer the questions, not to dig down into the details. I love these ideas. More importantly, I love what engaging with them has done in my life over the last 23 years. It has fundamentally changed me and my experience of the events of my life, and I wish to share that with each of you. And I wish the same for each of you as well. Just a word of wisdom from J.G. Bennett. I am a work in progress, and so are my thoughts. So the content, and so is the content that I'm going to share. The work teaches us to verify it for ourselves. So I'm going to show you some things, some constructs that have just become inspired to me. Take it as that and verify it for yourself. So let's do a brief review of the knowledge associated with causality and time. First, causality establishes, at least as like we would normally understand it, it establishes a sequential relationship between events. You know, one event being the cause of the other and the other one being the effect. So it's kind of this relationship between events. And then you have time, which is really related to objects in motion. This is, you know, more coming from physics. You don't have to think too much about this, but if you can picture, we're gonna think of objects in motion as events. Okay, think about, you know, playing basketball or whatever, you know, works for you. That event is in motion. Time is meaningless without motion. Okay. Time also establishes the duration between events. So our, you know, through the law of relativity, which you don't really need to understand in depth, our perception of causality and time related to events are, you know, what's said as relative to the position of the observer. So just a simple example of this would be all time that we are, you know, that we reference, it's all based on, our measures are based on the movement of the Earth around the sun. Okay. And then we measure time around, you know, spinning around the axis and the moon around the Earth. It's all based on an Earth point of view. The orbit of the Earth around the sun is different than all the other planets. So if you were positioned, if you put yourself on another planet and you started considering time, you would have a different reference point. Your perception of time would be different. So it is plastic in that way. Okay. So let's take an example. We have an event. High-speed vehicle collision. This is something that actually happened to me years ago. Driving down Mopac, 70 miles an hour, and a car three lanes over blows a tire, comes across and hits me. The whole thing happened in about 3 to 5 seconds, maybe less. The simple cause and effect way to look at that event that occurred would to say they lost control of the vehicle and hit me. There was a cause, they lost control, they hit me, that's the effect. And that's the way we typically look at things. We try to draw a very quick conclusion about what's going on by just saying this happened and therefore that's it. And it usually ends up, you know, trying to result in some sort of blame or, you know, making it a fault. So that's the cause-effect relationship. Now, in that event, my perception of time slowed way down. I remember the entire spinning of the car. I remember other cars coming at me, you know, in great detail. That event seemed to take a lot longer. And there's a technical reason for that, the way our brain works, is that the body goes into fight or flight mode, and the brain is trying to process all the information as rapidly as possible. And therefore, it seems as if everything is slowing down, but you are heightened awareness. You're actually receiving all that information. So which is the correct time? Is it our perception or was it the clock? And what would you do with that? Well, if you had the opportunity to expand your view of an event, like I just described with that car accident, and you could choose that and do it on purpose, you would expand your perception of certain events, and you would probably narrow down your perception and your memory of others. Now, the work challenges us to rethink everything, actually. But in this case, it's telling us to rethink cause and effect. And the law of seven comes into play. This quote was in the email, and it's an important one because it lays out a scale of how things work. It lays out a scale of order. So I'll just kind of skip to the middle here where he says, now order implies scale, one thing below another or one thing above another. Take end, cause, and effect. Those three are in different scales, like do, si, la. If la represents the effect, then si represents the cause and do represents the cause of the cause. That is the end or the aim. Okay. When you have an end or an aim in view, you cannot have an effect unless it, in between, you find a cause to produce the effect. So what this is establishing is the beginning and the end are the same. They're kind of the same. We'll get to this. But what we think of as cause and effect, it's not a two-way street. The law of three comes in here. If cause of the cause and the effect, and the end is in mind at the beginning. That's the key. So let's try to apply this to the work and an event. Let's remember that the position of the observer establishes the perception of the event and the time. So in the work, we establish an observer inside of ourselves, separate from our experience of the event. When we do this, we're self-observing and not identifying. And we see here that our thoughts or our memories of the event are also separate, and that the memory is the cause of the cause, whether we're conscious of it or not. That's the key. This is the essence of the work, is to reclaim our memories. If our memories are the cause of our experience, we would want to be conscious of our memories. So think of the example I shared regarding my sharing. That is now a conscious memory. It's a permanent part of me, and it influences my decisions. Just like Tim's, now let's keep it brief, Ken. Now, as we do this over and over again, this is self-remembering. And it has to be done over and over and over again because we are reclaiming the memories of who we are and why we're here. This is the aim of the work. So I try to think of a way to represent the ideas of causality and time in a practical way and tie it back to our work on ourselves. And I'm using here the octave of creating a book that was included in an email a few weeks ago. I actually got this inspiration from a discussion we had in our journey group last week. So following from top to bottom here, the aim is to write a book. And at this point, it's just a thought. But once you've made the decision to write the book, now you begin to start making choices and establishing a plan. Let's call this the cause. And here these thoughts are transformed into memory for sake of analogy. to get from the planning to the actual writing and producing of the book or the end, you actually need to transform your memories into physical form. You need to write it down. So then why is this so hard? Well, it comes down to making choices of what to keep and what to discard. And as you get further down in the process, there's more choices to make. You have to choose which parts of the book are most important and you know, which parts to expand and, you know, which parts are, you know, less and you want to shrink those. So it actually looks like this. Now, there's a lot on here, but I'll draw your attention to kind of the middle. I'm showing here the increasing complexity of choices that have to be made. And as Michael reviewed a few weeks ago, the complexity increases with the number of laws at each level of the ray. So I've represented that by the number of squares that are equivalent to the number of laws. And I've highlighted kind of the initial impulse after the decision to write a book, those three yellow squares there. And you can see that as you progress through the process of the creating the book, complexity of choices of what to expand and what to shrink increases. And while the original impulse, those three little yellow boxes are still present at every level in the process, it's very easy to lose sight of them amidst all the other choices. That's why it's so hard to create something. So what if the book is our story? What if, you know, that's the case? Where are we in this process? So let's take that construct and overlay it to our personal story. So on the right is my interpretation of, let's say, the book of creation. The work tells us we are way down low in the ray at the level of world 48, shown here by the note me. This is a world of cause and effect, endless recurrence, things repeating over and over again. In this example, we are endlessly writing and rewriting the manuscript of our life. We have forgotten the plan, we've forgotten why we're here, so we just keep going in circles. But we know the way out. The way to remember is through the work. So in this interpretation, the work becomes a shock that helps us remember our life, why we're here. We chose this life. We need to remember our choices. This is where the work comes in. But the work only works if we do it. And we have to put it on. We have to give it our attention. We have to love it. So just a few of my experiences to illuminate this. There's no idea in the work that drew me in more than the idea of the time body. My first memory of this is during a Thursday class. One of our friends was sharing her experience of when she first learned of the death of her father. Some of you might remember this. In that moment, Tim walked her through a guided meditation. He had her recall the details of the event, the emotions she felt, the thoughts she was thinking, and the physical sensations going on in her as a child when she learned that news. And then he said, "You're there with her now. Tell her you made it, that everything is going to be okay." Now, I don't know what her experience of that moment was, but for me, it was game changing. I thought, wow, I can do that. I can go back in time, change my experience of the past. That met me at the right time when I needed Some of you know our oldest daughter has special needs. Most see her as just the sweetest angel, and she's every bit of that. And at the same time, it's been difficult. When she was a child, I simply did not understand, and there were times when I was less than kind, and it affected our relationship. I used to read her books at night, but that stopped. She really didn't want much to do with me. So I put this idea on. I went back in time to a number of events, and I did my work. It was tough. It was tough work. It took forgiving myself. And in time, our relationship changed. I began to see her differently, and the past was healed. And our relationship is not perfect today, for sure. But I can tell you one thing, no matter what happens on any given day between us, at the end of the day, she still asks me, now 21 years old, to read her a book at night. Another key idea I've used so many times is to set a future memory. I can't really go into this a lot, but this is so powerful. It's very difficult for me to explain. It's difficult to go into what this idea really is, but it's absolutely true that what you hold in your mind will come to pass. The difficulty is separating from the idea and making the, from the idea of making the event happen. It's not about that. It's about choosing how to be present in your being when things happen. Our being does draw our life, but it's knowing how to respond to the moments that matter. And more and more, I'm learning that. Just a word on making payment, because it can be hard work. One of the tools I found most useful is just asking the Spirit for help. I pray the Jesus prayer nearly constantly. This has given me the space and the patience to do the work. Like I felt compelled to share an experience this evening, I felt compelled for a long time to write. And it has been a struggle, but more recently, maybe about starting 2 years ago, it's beginning to feel more natural. It helps me tremendously just to get the thoughts out of my head. It's been a very, very useful tool. I know some of you are journalers. It's been a struggle for me, but I'm finding it very useful, and I am beginning to journal. So consider writing down what you learn. One last idea that germinated with me for a long time was finding the event that solidified the personality, that kind of defining moment. For many years, I was convinced that I didn't have one. I felt like I had a pretty normal youth, good parents, et cetera. And I remember asking Tim one time on a Thursday night, I said, is it really that important to search for this? And his reply was, you'd want to know who's asking the question. I worked on that for a while, long time. So I kept searching. Here are some examples of some of the key works that have informed my passion for the work and time. Each one of these are huge in and of themselves, but I want to point to one that opened the door for me. It's Tertium Organum. And I can't really recommend this book because I only know like two or three people at the church who have even heard of it, much less read it. It is a bit heady, but it changed everything for me. It was written by Peter Ouspensky. And I was so heartened to hear Marianne introduce him this evening. I always knew him as Mr. O from the commentaries. Honestly, he and Gurdjieff might as well have been like mythical unicorns for most of my years in the work. I did not read their works or really know anything about them until I came across this book. But it met me at a time when I was open. 2 years ago on retreat, during Lent, and systematically with his logical writing, it blew my mind open about all things related to time and space and beyond. And in that opening, that defining moment for me was revealed. I saw it very clearly, the beginning of my personality and the programs that were written. It was an innocent event that happened when I was waking up from surgery when I was 6 years old. But I didn't understand what was happening then, and it set things in motion, just like for the rest of us. But what I've come to understand that Mr. O was really, as Marianne was highlighting, and he was a primary driver of the developing cosmology of the work, and his students developed it even further. In reading that book, I felt like I knew him personally. He spoke to me so clearly, almost as a friend, like as a guide. It was personal. I know that sounds strange, but it's true. I found that in preparing for this presentation, as I was writing, some of what was coming out was like almost in his logical progression. It was almost uncanny. So I'd like to share a brief experience that was the beginning of my interest in time, and the one that I felt compelled to share that drew me here tonight. In 1997, I was in New Orleans with some friends for Jazz Fest. We entered a busy town square early one afternoon, and I noticed an older man sitting at a table. He was a fortune teller. There were four of us. And since we had nothing better to do, we engaged the man. We asked what his price was, and he said, after we're done, just pay what you feel it's worth. And we all sat down. As he began with the first girl, he said, I see you ran away at the age of 10. She started to cry. In that moment, it was a sphere surrounded us, took us outside of time, and we were transfixed by all that he shared. He spent 1 hour on each of us, 4 hours in total. We sat at his little table and spoke to us of our past and our futures in such detail. And while he told me many things, it's this that stands out. He said, I see you've experienced a lot of suffering. You will suffer for a time more, but your suffering will come to an end. Somewhere about this time, you'll acquire a fortune and you'll want for nothing. He also said something about writing a book. When he finished and it came time to pay, I put 20 bucks in his jar. You know, when emptying my wallet would not have come close to what that experience was worth. But he simply thanked us and folded his table and went away. We went back several times to find him. Never saw him again. Three of us have stayed friends over the years and continue to meet for each other's birthdays. And while common memories have faded, we all remember two specific things from that event. His strange name on the sign was on the table. And the last thing that he said to me, as he was holding my hand, he looked at me and he said, you know, you can do this too. I said, do what? He said, what I'm doing here. Look into the past and the future, serve others. I initially thought that he meant what I was going to be was a fortune teller. But I soon learned that that was not it. That experience is really what ignited my interest in time and causality. I wondered how this man could open my mind and see such things, especially things that had not happened. In that open mind, he planted seeds that gave me hope. And I went in search of my fortune and the end of my suffering. That search changed my path. It led me to change where I worked. I soon met my wife, and it led us from the Catholic Church to find CCH in the work. Now, I realize now the payment that he was referring to was a struggle with and put on the ideas of the work, to engage conscious labor and intentional suffering, to apply the ideas to my being so that I could gain understanding, so that I could remember why I'm here and to fulfill that aim. Making payment was how to end my suffering and to claim my fortune. So I could inspire others to do the same. The man's name on the sign, which meant nothing to me at the time, was Mr. O. That's not the end, because we discovered tonight that the end is the beginning, and it didn't begin there. The story began a few years before that, when I read The Road Less Traveled. Now, this was the first time that I had ever heard of psychology tied to Christianity, and that was a shock. I distinctly recall two ideas that changed everything: that everyone needed psychotherapy, that our purpose is to live the life of Christ, a life of compassionate service to others in the world. Now, my response to the first one was, no way, I don't need psychotherapy, I'm normal. But it bugged me and it stuck with me. Regarding the second idea, I instantly knew that to be true for me, and I said yes. And then I thought, that sounds really hard. How do you do that? Saying yes to living the life of Christ, sensing it would be difficult, and asking the question, how do I do that, was the awakening of magnetic center in me. It has been that question, how do I live the life of Christ, that fueled my journey. And clearly those two ideas led me to the fortune teller, who opened my mind to the ideas of time and causality, and ultimately led me to the Church of Conscious Harmony and the work. And that book is inside the walls of Theosis Chapel. So putting this all together, here's the octave of remembering my aim that I just laid out. It started with awakening magnetic center and led me to the work. The aim to live the life of Christ is in sight. Just do the work. As we do the work, we begin to remember our life, why we're here, why we write it out consciously. We write the ending, and then we start to live it out. So what happens when we're finished? When we've lived the life that we choose, and we've come to the end, which is a new beginning. A life lived as Christ is one of conscious choice and compassionate service to others. So where do we begin? Well, we begin with the end in mind. Do the work. Study the pieces to remember your beginning. Write your ending and live it out. That's all I have to share. We have a couple minutes. Howard, please.
So I seem to be having some video problems, but I just wanted to mention, and that was an incredibly good sharing. Thank you for that. Tetramorganum, yes, that is an incredible piece of work, and I think I'm going to have to read it again, because I stumbled on it greatly trying to read it previously. But I also wanted to mention The Theory of Eternal Life is my all-time favorite work by Bennett, and I would recommend that to the world. And so thank you for that.
Absolutely, thank you. Yes, the Eternal Life is a fantastic book, I agree. Dennis, please.
Well, thank you for that, Ken. I've always been resistant to writing, and but I have these shocks that have occurred throughout my life, and I would say my aim from way back is to become closer to God, and hearing you say writing it, I could have all these different things and ideas floating around in my head. And I think it might be time to start putting them down and trying to organize my thoughts, because I'm, as you described in the beginning, my thoughts are just a jumble. And when I try and express them, it's, I don't know how they're coming out, but it just seems like a jumbled mess. And so I'm sometimes just feel resistant to share, because I don't know if it's going to come out very coherently. But I think tonight listening to you sort of planted that seed about begin to put it down, write it down, and organize it, and help start with the beginning and start with the end in mind. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. I wouldn't worry too much about organizing. To me, I just write it down. My filing mechanism is terrible. I capture notes on my phone. I capture them on my computer. I write them by hand. I have different journals. I know where they are. That's what's important. I know that I wrote it down because I remember that I wrote it down, and it gets it out of my head. And I highly recommend it if you're an intellectual type. Yeah. Well, it seems we are at the end of our time. Mary Ann, back to you. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ken. And I want to circle back to something that you said at the beginning too, which is each one of us here has our own destiny. Each one of us is doing our work, or it matters how we do our work. It's an incredible thing when our school is made up, and tonight there are 165 of us. Any one of the 165 could be out front, and we would all benefit from it. So let us never forget that. And thank you. You touched my mind, but also my heart. Thank you. Let us join together in praying, affirming the prayer of God's love. God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep, rest in